Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The Bush administration is under increasing pressure to do something, to say something that might clarify the status of prisoners being held at Guantanamo Bay. There are about 660 men there from dozens of different countries. Many have been there now for over 20 months, and still, most of them have not been charged. They are living in a state of legal limbo as enemy combatants without any of the rights given to prisoners of war. Since the detentions, only one organization other than the U.S. government has had access to the prisoners, and last week the International Committee for the Red Cross took the unusual step of speaking out, noting a high incidence of suicide attempts and the ongoing uncertainty for the detainees. The ICRC rebuked the U.S. and called for due process for the prisoners of Guantanamo. Also last week, a group of former judges, military officials, and diplomats filed briefs with the Supreme Court. They are worried that the U.S. is losing its international standing as a nation based on the rule of law. They quote a warning from Benjamin Franklin saying that, quote, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." Connection listeners, the U.S. government continues to insist that the men at Guantanamo are immune from international law because they are enemy combatants and because they may be a source of useful information. Is that good enough for you? Are you concerned that America's standing as a nation based on the rule of law is being compromised by its actions at Guantanamo? And what are the implications for American prisoners of war in the years ahead? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with us today, the dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center, John Hudson, has spent 30 years studying issues where the law and the military intersect. He has been a judge advocate general in the Navy with the rank of Rear Admiral. He was also commanding officer and dean of the Naval Justice School. He's joining us from the studios of WEVO in Concord, New Hampshire. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Glad to be here, Dick.
John, we asked the Department of Justice to have someone also join us on the show, and they said no.
But they didn't come, did
That's
they?
Right. But, I mean, the argument's been pretty consistent, that they say, look, these are terrorists. These are not soldiers wearing the uniform of a country, and so they don't deserve the sorts of rights of an ordinary prisoner of war. Is that argument, doesn't that argument carry any weight with you?
Well, the problem is that it assumes the issue. These people are either unlawful combatants or they're POWs, and it makes a difference. You said earlier that they weren't being accorded any of the rights of POWs, and I'm not sure that's entirely true. I think that they are probably being treated quite well. But the issue is, what is their status? And we can't simply assume that their status is terrorists. And the Geneva Conventions are quite clear in requiring that determination be made, and that determination be made by what's referred to as a competent tribunal, not the conclusion of somebody in the Department of Justice. So that's the issue. Requiring that the United States military create a so-called competent tribunal in order to resolve the issue of the status of these prisoners.
Now,
detainees.
To have the status enemy combatant, does that not mean anything? Does that not have any meaning in law as the term prisoners of war has meaning in law?
Sure. To be a lawful combatant, there are indicia of that you were in the command of somebody competent and authorized to give you orders, that you wear a uniform that is distinctive from a distance, that you carry your arms openly. These are the kinds of things that determine that whether or not a person is a lawful combatant, in which case they'd be a prisoner of war when captured,
right,
or an unlawful combatant, in which case they are something else and then don't have the rights of a prisoner of war, which, to be protected by the Geneva Conventions, to be immune from prosecution for warlike activities, and then to be repatriated at the end of hostilities.
Now, John, I know that there have been cases brought all the way up to the Supreme Court level, and that gave you and a group of other people an opportunity to put this case to the Supreme Court. But as I mentioned earlier in the program, it's been almost 2 years. Why choose to speak out now? Why is this an issue today if it wasn't an issue a year ago?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I have to tell you, and this isn't going to be a very satisfying answer perhaps, but for me, it was that very passage of time. I didn't feel strongly, and the conventions don't require, nor do the U.S. military regulations require, that this competent tribunal be conducted within 3 days or a week or a month or even a year. But now, now we're at much more than that. And the problem for me is simply that this is a war on terrorism, which we all understand is going to go on for a long, long time, indefinitely. There's no particular end in sight. In World War I and World War II, you may not have known exactly when it was going to be over, but you knew that it would be over. But in this case, the war on terrorism, there's not going to be a truce that's signed on the decks of the USS Missouri. When will it be over? How will we know? And that's what I think drives the need to have some sort of determination about the status of these folks, because otherwise they could be there and die as old men someday.
We will talk through this hour about the status of them and what the implications are for the United States. But if you could just hang on for half a second, John, I'd like to bring Christine Husky in. She's one of the lawyers representing a number of the Kuwaitis currently being held at Guantanamo. Christine's with the Washington office of Shearman and Sterling, and hers is, in fact, the case that's currently before the Supreme Court. She's joining us on the phone. Hi, Christine.
Hi.
Tell me, now, you're not technically defending these men in Guantanamo because they haven't been charged, right?
That's right. I was going to say, I wish I was, but unfortunately they are not being charged.
So what can you tell us? What do you know? Can you see these prisoners? Can you talk to them?
Well, I mean, this is a really unprecedented event in America. I'm a lawyer, and I have absolutely no contact with my client. It's very difficult to advocate on their behalf or to even say anything when I can't talk to them. I don't know their stories. I can't, say what they'd like to say to some, impartial tribunal or competent tribunal.
So you've been hired by relatives of these people to try and represent them?
That's right. Their parents, their wives, their brothers have come and asked us to represent them.
And when you contact the proper authorities at Guantanamo Bay and say, can I meet such and such a person, or can I get this list of questions answered, what are you told?
Actually, it's very interesting. We of course, sent a letter a while ago saying, we have clients at Guantanamo Bay, and, we would like to talk to somebody about them. And we got two kind of separate letters back, one saying, that's not in our area. You need to speak to, these other people. And then those other people, of course, sent a very similar letter saying, that's not in our area. You need to speak to. And then they pointed the finger at somebody else. So I think it's just, we've just been stonewalled. And there's clearly, there's not going to be an opportunity for lawyers to go down anytime soon.
Did you see it as something of a turning point last week when the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, spoke out?
That was also unprecedented. I mean, that's just never happened. They really try to maintain neutrality so that they can continue having access, and they never speak out publicly. It's their policy. And to do that really, really has got to raise concern among, clearly in the Supreme Court and among, the international community and the United States.
Now, you're also keeping an eye on how other nations are taking a look at what's going on at Guantanamo Bay. Are you seeing any evidence at all that other countries are looking at the way the U.S. is handling these so-called enemy combatants and using that as some kind of precedent or example?
Yes, well, I think it's, I do believe this is part of the reason that so many amici spoke out from different sectors, and particularly relevant to the international community.
Amicus is people joining the court
case,
right?
Yes, I'm sorry, such as the retired military officers and the ex-diplomats and
right.
the former prisoners of war, is that this has had such an effect in the international community. And, you know, and the United States is part of that community, and we have to realize that, and we're leaders. And some countries, such as Malaysia, and I believe Egypt and other African countries have actually pointed to Guantanamo and said, don't you criticize us about how we hold people in the name of national security and don't charge them and we hold them indefinitely, because we are looking to Guantanamo as our model. And also, I know that Castro, criticized about, I don't know, 6 months ago for human rights violations. He said, if you want to look to human rights violations, look no further than Guantanamo Bay. I mean, that's frightening that Castro would accuse the United States of that.
Christine, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Christine Husky is a lawyer with Shearman & Sterling. It's a law firm representing 12 Kuwaiti men being held as prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. As I mentioned earlier in the program, we have with us John Hudson. He's dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center. And John, the brief that you gave to the Supreme Court focused very specifically on the USA's stature as a nation guided by the rule of law. Do you share Christine's right. real concern about how this is being seen outside the borders of this country?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In the United States holds itself out, and quite rightly and justifiably, as being an international leader. We want other countries to emulate us, or we should want other countries to emulate us. And I'm not sure that you can sit here and really believe that in this respect we would want other countries to emulate us. We are not conducting ourselves, I believe, in this situation, in a way that we would want to be have other countries treat people, U.S. prisoners. You know, we've since 1825, we have gone to other countries with our soldiers over 200 times, and those soldiers, sailors, Marines, inevitably are captured. And we want them to be treated as we would treat people. And we use, you know, it's a two-sided sword. It will be used against us if we don't do it right. And we can use it on behalf of those people, those prisoners, if we do it right. And Christine is absolutely right. There are examples going both ways where we have demanded Michael Durant in 1993 in Somalia. We demanded that they be that he be treated as a prisoner of war, and it goes the other way as well.
All right, Connection listeners, when we come back after the break, we'll talk with a man who was held as a prisoner of war in the Second World War to get his sense of how this may play out in the future. We'd also like to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Do you believe that the passage of time, the length of time that those men have been held at Guantanamo Bay, is forcing the United States to some point where it's going to actually have to more specifically define their status? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And this hour, Connection listeners, we're talking about the status of prisoners being held at Guantanamo Bay, what the implications of their uncertain status might be for American prisoners of war in the future. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With us on the program, Rear Admiral John Hudson, Dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center, who served in the U.S. Navy from 1973 to the year 2000. Lots of experience as a judge advocate general. And Connection listeners, we have been listening and talking to the way that lawyers explain the possible legal ramifications of Guantanamo Bay. But we also wanted to hear the thoughts of a man who spent time as a prisoner of war. Leslie Jackson is now joining us from his home in Bethesda, Maryland. Hello, Leslie.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, you were captured in April 1944. Where were you when you were picked up?
I was very near Munich at a town called Füssen, Germany. We were shot down. Our target was Munich. And I was interned in Stalag 17B, which is in Krems, Austria.
And when you were taken to the camp, were you fearing for your life at that point?
Most definitely.
What did the Germans say to you? Or was there any communication there?
Well, they interrogated us a couple of times. I was interrogated when I was immediately after I was captured by the German army that was there in that area where we hit the ground.
Uh-huh.
We were interrogated there, and then we were put on a train to a place called Dulag Luft, which is in Frankfurt, Germany. Went up there where the professional interrogators took over, and we were interrogated once again. And then we were, after interrogation, after they decided what to do with us, they shipped us off in the boxcars to Stalag 17.
Now, after you were interrogated, you had some reason to believe that you just weren't going to be taken out back and shot, right?
Yeah, well, that was always a possibility. We didn't know from one minute to the next what was going to happen to us, because we'd heard all kinds of stories about how the prisoners were treated. And they weren't always treated according to the Geneva Convention, which we'd hoped they would. But the Geneva Convention was a protection for us to an extent. The nation holding us had the right to completely abide by the Geneva Convention, or to pick and choose those parts that they wanted to invoke.
So, Mr. Jackson, is it reasonable to say that as a prisoner of war, you kind of were able to hope that you'd be treated at least decently because it was known that the U.S. had a reputation for treating its own prisoners of war at least decently?
We knew how prisoners that were being held by the United States were being treated, and we knew that the Germans and the United States were signatories to the Geneva Conventions of, back in those days, that was six decades ago. And we had some sort of security in the feeling of knowing that Geneva Convention was protecting us.
And so when you watch what's happening at Guantanamo Bay, do you share John Hudson's concern that the reliability of international law may be a little bit shaken now?
Yes. Yes. The United States must set an example for the rest of the world as to how we treat our POWs, because there's going to be an opportunity for other nations to turn it around and take our prisoners, and how will our prisoners be treated? It concerns me.
Can I ask you, Leslie, though, to look at it from the side that the administration would have us see this? You were asked to fight to defend your country. You wore the uniform of a U.S. soldier, and what the people we're talking about in Guantanamo Bay, at least based on what we know of them, is that they were much closer to the status of mercenaries, people who were fighting a battle either for some sort of religious reason or some sort of or for some sort of money. There isn't a parallel there, is there?
No. They're being held, as I understand it. They haven't been classified as POWs or enemy combatants, or they haven't been classified at all. I don't even know that they've been interrogated. They're just there.
So why should we worry about their status then?
For humanitarian reasons. If we don't treat people decently, what can we expect in return?
So you look at what's happening there, you think about the possibility that a grandson or a granddaughter of yours might wear an American uniform at some point in the future, and wonder whether or not they'd get even the same, you know, dignity or treatment in the field that you got.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a question of human rights.
Leslie, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I appreciate your time. John, I hear you wanting to come in there.
Sorry.
No, it's all right.
Forgive me. I didn't realize I was quite that. Leslie makes an excellent point. And the unfortunate reality is that through time, the face of war is changing. You know, it used to be that war was essentially linear. There was a beginning and there was a middle and eventually there was an end. Now, warfare is becoming increasingly asymmetrical. There's not a clear beginning. There's not a clear middle. There's not even a clear enemy. You know, we're not fighting a nation state. We're fighting this sort of vague group of people.
So by asymmetrical, you mean not one army versus another army.
Right, exactly, precisely. And that's the way it looks as though it's going to be, you know, for the foreseeable future. I think that requires certain changes. You know, the Geneva Conventions have evolved. The convention that was in place during World War II was in 1929. Since then, as a result of World War II, we had to make changes. The United States, by the way, led. And then in 1955, we ratified the changes. But
Right. There
is a thing in international law called customary law. International law evolves by custom. It doesn't necessarily always evolve by treaty. The impact of that in this case is that we are now creating customary international law by what it is we do, to the extent we follow the Geneva Conventions or to the extent that we don't follow the Geneva Conventions. And if we're saying that, okay, that's the way it is in wars between nation states, but in this ever-increasing kind of asymmetrical war, then the rules are different. Well, we need to be careful about that because, you know,
you're saying customary international law, as you're defining it, is actually being changed right now by what is happening or what is not happening at Guantanamo.
Yes, sir. That's what precisely that, and it's already happening, as we mentioned earlier with Christine, that countries are using it against us now, saying, "Hey, you know, this is the way you're doing it," and it through time, this can become the law, and we need to step back and say, do we really want this to be the international law in the future, in a world in which asymmetrical warfare is going to be the norm rather than the exception?
Let's hear from some of our callers, if we can. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. First to Raleigh, North Carolina, and Carl's on the line. Hi, Carl.
Hey, how you doing, Dick?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Good. I just want to say, first of all, that, Dick, you do a wonderful job of being unbiased and I think you kind of carry the NPR crew as far as that respect. You do a lot better than some of your peers.
Thank you for that, Carl. Let's hear what you've got to say on this one.
Okay, well, I served in the military, in the Army, for 6 years, and I actually have a friend of mine that died in Afghanistan, and I have friends of friends that have passed away in Iraq. My concern is that I think internally we're more concerned with the rights of our enemies and international opinion and things like that. And we really need to take another look because I think we need to be more focused on security of our nation and also the safety of our soldiers. I mean, it almost seems
But Carl, isn't that exactly what John's saying, that by projecting something to other countries, i.e. the international opinion, we are actually – you know, there is some change or effect on the safety or the security of U.S. soldiers who may serve abroad.
Sure, I agree. But I think in some of the areas where we're at right now, it's important to realize that, unfortunately, not everybody plays by the rule book anyway. And I think we need to reexamine the rule book, as already been stated. But I think no matter what the United States does, they never do enough. When we do get involved, we were involved improperly. And when we don't get involved, we should have got involved. So you really can't do it right. You just need to look at the rule book as it is, I think modify it, and do what's in the best interest of our nation.
Just hang on for half a second, Carl, because I'd like to hear from John on this. John, in a speech that the president made in your state last week, he said, you know, this is a new kind of war, and the United States has to adjust. It's a new kind of war, and America is following a new strategy. Isn't that the new rule book that Carl's talking about?
Yeah, I think that those words are exactly right. It's a new kind of war, and the United States has to adjust. That's true. That was my earlier point. I think Carl's point is well taken. But we're not suggesting that these prisoners, detainees, have their cases heard by a court. We're only suggesting that there be a tribunal to determine their status. So I don't think that that has a dramatic impact on the immediate safety of the United States or our soldiers. In fact, I think that this is going to ultimately operate to the disadvantage, kind of ironically or counterintuitively, it will operate to the disadvantage of those very detainees. Because what's very likely to happen is that the tribunal that hears their case and determines their status is going to decide that they're not POWs because they didn't, wear the uniform and bear their arms openly and so forth. And so that therefore they're not immune from their warlike acts, and therefore that they may be prosecuted. In the end, I think this is going to open up prosecutions of the detainees rather than simply repatriating them at the end of the hostilities, whenever that may be, which is what would happen if they were, in fact, POWs.
Carl,
so I think that this is going to operate to increase the safety of our soldiers and our citizens.
Carl, you mentioned you had friends in uniform overseas. Just the basic notion that what goes around comes around, and the way that these folks in Guantanamo Bay are handled is the way that your friends captured in the future might be handled. Tell me what you think about that.
Well, I understand the short-term and long-term thinking, and you have to weigh everything out. But like I said before, the people that we're dealing with, a lot of situations will come about to where it's not a formal nation's army that takes our soldiers.
Right.
And I really question that no matter what we do, our soldiers will be treated fairly anyway. It's not like we're talking about World War II and the Germans and the Japanese. We're talking about rogue bands of terrorists in many cases or supporters of terrorism. I don't feel as though they're going to follow the rules anyway. So as far as us being fair to their combatants, I don't see where short-term or long-term that would really affect the people that I care about, which are the soldiers out overseas.
All right, Carl, thanks for your call. John, just briefly, I mean, an example, if you would, say, from Somalia, when the U.S. was insisting that the warlord Idid handle Americans in a way that was commensurate with international law. Are you saying that the American argument is somehow weaker today?
Well, yes. I think it is. I mean, it all is not lost, and we certainly have opportunity to recover
right.
that by saying that we're going to use these tribunals. But sure, the argument is somewhat weaker. And I think that simply because we don't believe that if our troops were captured by terrorists or al-Qaeda, that they would be treated well, that's not necessarily a reason to not try. I think it's not a reason to not try for two reasons. One is that we are, after all, the United States of America. We're the greatest country on the face of the earth, and we are able to do this, and we should, therefore, do it. And because other countries don't follow what is perhaps our too-hard-to-follow lead because we're doing things so well,
right.
Isn't a reason not to continue to do it.
Let the standards of the U.S. be set by the founding fathers, and don't try and match
Absolutely.
The standards of
absolutely. And if the other if other countries can't or won't match it, oh well. But one, we will have set the standard,
right.
and two, we will feel good about what it is we've done. Because I'll tell you, when this war is over, whenever that may be, as in many wars throughout history, we will be judged as much by historians for how we handled this part of it as we will be judged for how we actually executed the war, prosecuted the war. That this part of it will be the shining example, or not, as the case may be, of the best or the worst of the United States.
To Louisville, Kentucky now. Tony's on the line. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
You're certainly welcome. I enjoy being on. I'm a retired Army officer, and I spent about 30 years in military service, and the young gentleman who spent a short time is missing the big point. The people who have been detained need to be either considered A, prisoners of war,
yes,
or B, criminals. In either case, under the terms of our constitutional democracy and all of the laws that we have, they need to be afforded all of those rights, and any of the rights that they are denied become reason to illegitimize any action that might be taken. So if they are found guilty of something, then by virtue of the fact that they were not given the appropriate rights under our system, then they go free according to our system. So the illegitimate act of putting them into Guantanamo, which was put there specifically to hide them from any other part of the country or the part of the world,
And away from the jurisdiction of the Constitution.
Away from the jurisdiction of the Constitution was a ploy specifically by people who should not be trusted in government right now, who want to overturn all of those constitutional defenses we have for ourselves,
Tony,
and
you,
for anybody else.
You said you had 30 years in. Does that mean that you're more concerned with how this will stand as an example, or just more concerned with how it makes the U.S. look now? Yeah, you are.
I absolutely am, because this means that our Geneva Convention protections are completely null and void. My daughter is a captain in the Air Force at this time, and I am concerned that we now have no opportunity to be afforded the defenses under any of those accords or those conventions that we had in the past. So now, regardless of the enemy, they have no obligation to treat us any better than we are treating those people detained in Guantanamo. And anything that we are due now with those people who are in Guantanamo is illegitimate, because
Tony,
the action has been illegitimate.
We have to take a break. I want to thank you for being with us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, exploring the implications and the ethics of the manner in which 660 men are being held at Guantanamo Bay and what it might mean for the U.S. in the future. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and we're talking about the status of the men being held at Guantanamo Bay and whether or not the United States has an obligation to define their status, to give them more or greater standing under international law. One of the quotes that pops up in a friend of the court brief that was signed by my guest, who's Rear Admiral John Hudson, was actually taken from a Supreme Court ruling back about 75 years ago in a landmark case where telephone wiretaps were being used to arrest a notorious bootlegger called Olmsted. Now, while that conviction against the bootlegger was allowed to stand, Chief Justice Taft had some very scorching words for the government. He said, and I'm quoting him here, "Our government is the potent, omnipresent teacher. For good or for ill, it teaches the whole people by its example. If the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for law. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. It invites anarchy." Justice Taft went on, "This nation has no right to expect that it will always have wise and humane rulers. Wicked men, ambitious of power, with hatred of liberty and contempt of law, may fill the place once occupied by Lincoln and Washington." Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, just a few thoughts from you, if we can get them, about whether or not the United States needs to do more to define the status of the people being held at Guantanamo Bay. Next to Buffalo, New York, and Joanna's joining us. Hi, Joanna.
Hi. Thank you for an excellent program. I agree it's the best on NPR and the most objective.
Yes.
I worked for many years on human rights in Peru, and Peru lived through 12 years of political violence and terrorism. And at some point, they passed special anti-terrorist legislation, which didn't lead to fair trials, mm-hmm. though everybody did receive a trial, I would note. The U.S. insisted that this legislation was unfair and needed to be reformed, and in fact, it was reformed. And the United States especially insisted in the case of Lori Berenson, who was involved with a Peruvian guerrilla or terrorist group, whichever way you want to look at it, and she did indeed receive another trial.
Yeah.
So, According to international law, everybody deserves a fair trial. And in my opinion, Guantanamo is one huge human rights violation.
So, Joanna, take me to Peru, if you can. Take me to the people that you know there and the experience that you had working in that country. Are you saying that people in Peru will be looking at Guantanamo Bay and judging the United States based on what happens there?
Oh, they already are, and they also are looking at the extrajudicial executions. President Bush smiles delightedly when the U.S. kills a terrorist abroad without, you know, any notion that according to international law, they're supposed to arrest those terrorists and bring them to trial. So it's making a very big impact everywhere around the world, I think.
And nothing changed on September 11th. You're saying that the administration doesn't have the standing to say, phew, this is a new war. These are new circumstances.
Well, this is, you see, what human rights violators all around the world have always said. They've always used it as an excuse to violate human rights. And when you do that, you become a terrorist. In a way, you become a terrorist yourself. I mean, who is going to stand for the rule of law?
John Hudson, pretty strong words that when you go by the rules of people who are terrorists, you become a terrorist yourself.
Well, I can't endorse that, I guess. I think that what we're doing in Guantanamo right now, not affording tribunals for these prisoners, is a violation of the Geneva Convention. I think that it is a mistake that we will, if we don't correct, we'll live to regret. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to support the philosophy that makes us terrorists, however.
Joanna,
let me
just ask Joanna one more question, though, Joanna, because one of the points John Hudson made earlier in the program is that if the United States were to change the rules at Guantanamo Bay, provide the competent tribunals that he and others are calling for, that the U.S. actually is still in a position to recoup its standing in international law. What do you think?
Well, if it changes its policies, it can recoup.
Right, that's what I meant.
The other point I would like to make is that it's giving a green light to human rights violators all around the world. You know, other governments will say, well, if the United States can do this and not give people a trial and hold them for unknown periods of time, well, they can't criticize us for doing that.
And the point was made earlier in the program by Christine Husky that claim has already been put on the record in countries like Eritrea and Egypt. So, Joanna, thanks for your call. Nice to have you on the program. To Yorktown, Virginia now. Steve's joining us. Hi, Steve.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate this forum.
Yeah, go ahead.
I would have to disagree with the previous caller that President Bush and his administration are smiling or laughing when someone dies from another nation. I assume she's talking about Saddam's brothers. If you'll remember, they were fighting to the very end.
Those are his sons, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I don't think that President Bush is taking any great pleasure in what's going on now at the cost of our fellow countrymen and women after September 11th.
Okay.
I also would like to comment that legitimate countries are going to see this for what it's worth. The people in Guantanamo Bay are not a legitimate, organized group of people that would follow the Geneva Convention in the first place. And I'm sure that those detainees are enjoying three hots and a cot, if you will.
Yeah.
I don't think the United States are treating them poorly at all. I don't think they should be able to communicate with their other terrorist allies to organize other acts against our country. So I think that we need to keep in perspective that these people aren't going to respect the lives that they will take into custody, and they're going to be treated poorly anyway, no matter how we treat their people.
Steve, it's a great point, and I want you to just hang on for half a second and let me bring John in here, because, John, you mentioned earlier in the program that, when I said that they weren't getting any of the treatment under international law, you corrected me in saying, look, they're probably getting good standards of health, cleanliness,
right,
the religious freedom that they would want. So tell Steve what's missing.
Well, I agree that they're being treated well. They're in some respects, they're probably, in terms of eating and so forth, they're probably living better than they did before they were captured. But process matters. you know, in a country that is controlled by the rule of law, process matters. And the United States can't just pick and choose which of the parts of the Geneva Convention they're going to enforce. You know, it's like, you know, I like the Bill of Rights except number 2, or I like the Ten Commandments except number 6. You know, you either comply with the Geneva Conventions or you don't. And we're saying, yeah, we're going to treat them well. We'll give them food and a bed and shelter and religious opportunity to practice their religion. But too bad you don't get the tribunal that the Geneva Convention requires and, oh, by the way, which U.S. military regulations, which incorporate the Geneva Convention in large measure, requires. You know, that one is just a bridge too far for us, so you don't get that one, because we really, really, really don't like you. You know, you didn't wear a uniform, and you probably, or somebody you may have known, did something really bad to us. So in this particular case, because we dislike you so much, we're not going to comply with international or national law.
Almost like a form of punishment before trial.
Right.
Steve, can I hear from you on this?
Well, I would respectfully disagree that it's my understanding the Geneva Convention recognizes legitimate organized armies, and these are not armies. These are, in my opinion, radicals with an agenda of their own, and they wouldn't follow the Geneva Convention anyway. And again, I would just suggest that organized and legitimate countries would do the same thing in our position.
John, back to you.
Well, you know, that's a point of view, I guess. You know, they're bad people, so we're going to you know, treat them badly. We said earlier that the only thing we're looking for here is a tribunal to determine their status. And, you know, what Steve just said assumes the results of that tribunal. You know, maybe they're just kids who happen to be on, you know, the road someplace and got picked up. You know, we don't know that yet, and that is the point, that we don't know it. But, you know, you can put three officers together and hold a tribunal and make those determinations and either release them or keep them in confinement.
September 11th had that same opportunity.
Sorry, Steve, complete that.
I would say that I wish my fellow countrymen and women had the opportunity to be tried and convicted instead of being killed by an airplane.
Go ahead, John.
I was just going to say we you know, that was nobody's arguing that that wasn't one of the worst things that's occurred in history, but it doesn't justify the United States conducting itself and behaving in a manner in which it hasn't behaved in history.
Steve, I want to thank you for your call. And John, just I'm curious. I listened to you describing the way you're thinking this through, and I know you have 30 years or better of experience as a lawyer, as a judge advocate general, dealing with the specific legal points of this. But I'm hearing a lot more, I don't know, emotional outrage than intellectual outrage over this. Is that fair?
Well, that's because I'm more emotional than smart, I suppose.
I just meant that this something that you're looking at as an intellectual puzzle. This is something you've been thinking a lot about.
Yeah, and I believe that as an intellectual puzzle, I mean, all you got to do is read Article 5 of Convention 3, and it says you give them a tribunal. So, I mean, that to me is not brain surgery, legal or intellectual or otherwise. So that what makes this particularly important to me, I guess, is two things. One is, and both things we've talked about, but one is how our prisoners and other prisoners from other countries will be treated in the future, which I think is profoundly important. But the other compelling reason, I think, is that we are the United States of America, and we can and should be doing this. It's not that hard. So why we're resisting it, and you know, the rules for these tribunals are laid out, and they're They're very simple. Three officers, one field grade officer, a judge advocate, as a recorder, if they're reasonably available. You know, this isn't the Supreme Court we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So why we're resisting this isn't entirely clear to me, because it would, I mean, there's 660 of them now because we've waited so long to do it. But as we were, if we were doing this sort of as we went along, we wouldn't be here. There wouldn't be people in the country like some of the earlier callers who are so concerned about this. So that this is partly because I have such great love and admiration and respect for what the United States has done in the past in this and in other kinds of human rights areas.
Well, but specifically on that, you reached the rank of Rear Admiral in the U.S. Navy. That meant you were in a position to see young men and women go off and defend this country and have a right. certain expectation of protection that would come from their superior officers and this country's right. leaders.
Right. Yes. And
are you afraid that contract, that compact is somehow being threatened?
Yeah, I mean that we can't expect young men and women to go to war with the same level of confidence that they will be treated in strict accordance with the Geneva Conventions because we have decided to pick and choose which articles we're going to enforce in this particular context, and I think that's. It's unfortunate for them, and it's unfortunate for the leadership position of the United States, a country that wants to otherwise be emulated by other countries.
John, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you, Dick.
John Hudson, former Judge Advocate General for the U.S. Navy, currently the Dean and President of the Franklin Pierce Law Center in Concord, New Hampshire. Earlier in the program, we talked with Christine Husky. She's a lawyer with Shearman & Sterling, the law firm that's representing 12 Kuwaiti prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. And Leslie Jackson was also with us. He's a former prisoner of war, was held for a year, 1944-1945. Our program is produced by Khalil Bird, Nancy Cohen, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugars. We had help today from Glenn Alexander, Matt Largy, Kim Bichari, John Hoder, Darren Minucci, and Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.